Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. Eastern Time in North America. That is 5 p.m. in the Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland, 6 p.m. for all my pals in Bermuda, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 p.m. in Europe, 11 p.m. in the Middle East, midnight, the midnight hour in Moscow. And all of us Kremlin agents like me and Tucker Carlson are waiting for our instructions from the Kremlin. They always send them over at midnight. That means it's Wednesday morning for our Asian and Pacific listeners, middle of the night for our chaps in India and honkers, and early morning in Oz, slightly more civilized hour of the day in New Zealand and beyond. But wherever you are, welcome to this Clubland Q&A live around the planet, where I take questions from Mark Stein Club members for the next hour. If you're not a Mark Stein Club member, you can join right now and ask a question, even as the show is in progress. I think 2 weeks ago we had somebody who joined up 20 minutes before we went to air and asked a question that very hour. Within the hour, we were answering that lady's questions. But you can sign up and join up now and ask a question while the show is in progress. That's the express check-in we've laid on for you. It might not happen, might not like your question. Might say, nuts to this question, better luck next time. But you can join the Mark Stein Club and ask a question in the next hour. Let us go to Benjamin Carr, who asks the question of the hour in the United States. Hey, Mark, pardon me for asking a rather broad question, but how do you see the release of the GOP Intel memo impacting the Robert Mueller investigation? Well, it's interesting to me that... Benjamin adds, P.S., I love your Stein posts. When's the next one coming out? Well, actually, the next one is coming out, I believe, either tomorrow or Thursday. I have to wear my 24-hour girdle for those, and it depends when it comes back from the dry cleaner. But I believe it's coming tomorrow or Thursday, a brand new Stein post. But Benjamin's question on this GOP Intel memo, it's already impacted the Mueller, it's not the so-called Russia investigation, because I think, you know, half the country... more than half the country doesn't regard the Russia investigation as a big deal. And half the country, half the United States, actually regards it as something other than a Russia investigation. To me, this is interesting because Trump isn't someone who just lets a process play out. If you go back a decade to when they were investigating Scooter Libby, regarding the leaking of Valerie Plame's name, George W. Bush never pushed back against a hostile press. He tried to be presidential and above it all. And the tragedy of that was that in the absence of any response, a lot of the left-wing narrative took hold and partially destroyed his presidency. Including in the Scooter Libby matter. Trump has pushed back, and I think it's fair to say that this investigation has not gone the way that you might have expected a special counsel investigation to go with a Republican administration. Now, I will say this about the GOP memo. One of the obvious factors of what's going on is that almost anything that comes out is bad for Democrats, because the people doing the stuff are either Obama administration high-ups or Clinton campaign operatives or members of the permanent bureaucracy, civil servants, who instead of checking their political beliefs in the cloakroom with the hat check girl before they settle down at their desk for the day, are in fact prosecuting their political beliefs in office via secret meetings and texts and memos and emails and so forth. And so I think it's reasonable to take the position that anything that comes out is bad for the Democrats. You saw that over this memo. in the most basic way, where they told us, oh, this is going to breach national security, we're going to burn sources, we're going to be betraying clandestine operatives in the field, the national security is at risk, blah, 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 blah. And there's none of that in the memo. The only three people mentioned are this Papadopoulos guy, who went drinking with my old friend Alexander Downer, the Australian High Commissioner in London, and who the New York Times and other risible buffoons claim is the real motivation for this investigation. I can tell you that's actually not the Australian view of these things. And the other one is this, the other two names, apart from Papadopoulos, are Christopher Steele. Christopher Steele is all over the newspapers, in part because he's a very weird self-promoter who wants to be all over the newspapers and is in contact with journalists and all the rest of it. And Carter Page, this relatively peripheral, brief Trump campaign volunteer, who was the subject of these FISA court orders subjecting him to 24/7 surveillance, renewed three times. In other words, from, I believe, October the 21st for a year, October 21st, 2016. So basically for the first year of the Trump presidency, this guy was under surveillance for no other reason than that he was briefly on the Trump campaign, and so he provided a pretext for them eavesdropping on the people he'd spoken to by telephone, which included numerous people in Trump Tower. Now, when you listen to the spin from people like Shepard Smith, for example, on Fox News, Shep was arguing the other day, this guy's a dodgy guy, he's been under investigation since 2013 as a suspected Russian agent. At a certain point, you have to put up or shut up. If he's been an agent of the Kremlin for 5 years, why hasn't he been charged by now? But I'll tell you something else, too. There may well be lots of secret Kremlin operatives in this business, as I said just at the top of the show. I'm an agent for the Kremlin. Tucker Carlson has been accused by Democrat congressmen of being an agent of the Kremlin. Let's take it as read that Adam Schiff and Nancy Pelosi are agents of the Kremlin. The one person you can rely on, take it to the bank, who isn't a Kremlin agent in all this, is Carter Page. Because the original application that revealed his identity in 2013, if you read that document, I read it because it happened to come up before this rather unimpressive judge that I've found myself in the same room as, a fellow called Frank Maas, very unimpressive fellow, but apparently the guy to go to if you just want a rubber stamp getting you a FISA court surveillance order. Anyway, the sealed complaint that first mentions Carter Page as Mail One in it of 2013. Now, this is a complaint about Russian agents operating in the United States. And if you know who the players are, as the Kremlin apparently does, you'll be able to work out who this Mail One was. So you'll know that Carter Page is in the sights of the United States government, so he's no use to you as an agent anymore. He's been burned, as all the super cool spooks say. So the one guy in all this you can rely on not being a Russian agent, granted we're all Russian agents. Trump's a Russian agent, Mike Pence is a Russian agent, everyone's a Russian. The one guy in all this you can rely isn't a Russian agent is Carter Page, because he's been no use to the Kremlin since 2013, when the United States government first put him under surveillance. So the basis on which they went to the court to get their surveillance of him was a crock, a complete crock, because they know he's of no value to the Russians. But he's of value to them, because the minute his name turned up, As someone connected with the Trump campaign, they were able to go to a judge and said, we'd like to surveil this guy on being a suspected Russian agent, not because of his contacts with the Russians, but because of his contacts with the Trump Tower. This is why I said on Tucker Carlson last night that this is secret police activities. He has no influence in Russia. He has no contacts in Russia worth anybody eavesdropping on. But Carter Page has contacts in Trump Tower, and that's who the government wanted to eavesdrop on. That's why this is secret police stuff. Let's take another question. Holly writes, "Hi, Mark. With all this power and lawless energy used in making sure that Donald Trump never came anywhere near the presidency, and presumably with the ability to control events, how did the deep state efforts fail? It's not enough to say Clinton was a terrible candidate and ran a poor campaign. The cheating was supposed to overcome those weaknesses. Is it actually the case that these people are not as powerful as they think they are? Has their corruption made them impotent even to manage their own corruption?" Now, that's an interesting way to look at it, Holly. I think it's this. I think that there's a kind of echo chamber. And the echo chamber works to deny the reality of the situation. And actually, it's particularly depressing that people who are supposed to be in the intelligence business actually have such a bad read on these things. But it makes you understand why they miss the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Pakistani nuclear program and all the rest of it, because they don't actually even understand their own country. People who agree with each other talk to other people who agree with each other, who pass on information they've gleaned from other people who agree with each other, and they all agree that Trump has no chance of victory. Trump, meanwhile, in September and October of 2016, was out working very hard. He was actually campaigning in key states. And what was, as I always say, what was spectacular about the Trump campaign, what I think actually is great for the American electoral process, is that he broke all the rules. He disregarded all the things he meant to do. He didn't really have a ground game in the sense of databases of lists and elaborate arrangements who to take to the polls when and all that. He just went and held rallies and in huge arenas, and people had a good time at them and went home and voted for him. He didn't have a lot of advertising. He didn't spend a lot of money. He didn't have a lot of consultants. And I think that's actually these people are not as powerful as they think they are. What they have going for them is that they control all the levers of influence, particularly the media. And in certain conditions and at certain times, they might have actually been able to effect the victory they assumed was in the bag. But in actual fact, it does demonstrate that when you detach yourself from the concerns of the people as much as the permanent bureaucracy and the media and the Democrats have, that there is a price to be paid for it. Now, I'm not overstating it. It's a 50-50 country. And yes, the popular vote went to Hillary and all the rest of it. But the fact is that the groupthink, the assumptions that everyone agrees with you, which in Washington was not just the Democrat Party, but it was half the Republican Party who couldn't stand Trump as well. There is a danger when you just surround yourself with people who agree with you. And it's surprising to have to explain that basic defect to people in the intelligence business. George Pereira, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Do let me know if I'm not, writes, "It seems to me that to a greater or lesser degree, Trump's appointments lack the fire of Trump himself. The most disappointing is Jeff Sessions. Is he A, a creature of the swamp, B, being blackmailed, C, incompetent, D, all of the above?" I think there's a lot of truth in that. That the Trump's appointments are in many ways un-Trumpian, but that's to be expected. He didn't come to Washington with a big coterie around him from state politics, the way, say, Bill Clinton did, with all these very sleazy figures who'd been operating around him in Arkansas. He just came fresh out of politics. And when he looked at people who were in the running for cabinet positions, he turned to far more conventional political figures. He had some unconventional political figures in there, the fellas like Steve Bannon and Sebastian Gorka and so forth, and those guys aren't around anymore, and it's a much more normal crowd. Jeff Sessions is a particular disappointment to me, as he is to most people, because I think you start from the premise that the Justice Department was became terribly politicized under Holder and Lynch during the Obama years, and that the politicization of the Justice Department is actually wicked, as is the politicization that happened at the IRS as well. And that there's, I can't believe, for example, that that buffoon who was always cocking a snook at Koskinen, who was always Koskinen, survived at the IRS for as long as he did. He should have been out as well. But I don't know why. I honestly don't know why Sessions. I think he sincerely recused himself. The interesting thing is that Bruce Orr, for example, felt no need to recuse himself because his wife was working for Fusion GPS. Bruce Orr felt no need even to tell Sessions that he was hopelessly compromised because his wife was working for Fusion GPS. So I think you have the usual thing where the Democrats stretch ethical boundaries to the very limit. And the Republicans are the guys who do the honourable thing and say and recuse at the first opportunity, and that's not a good position. Scott Scherzer says, Mark, I heard a rumour that Netflix is going to remake the Keystone Cops. The current cast includes James Comey, Andrew McKay, Bruce Orr, Peter Strzok, and Lisa Page. Any recommendations for additional cast members? You know, I wish they were Keystone Cops, but they've all got their jobs. They've all got their pensions. I mean, basically, James Comey should have been fired on day one or asked to resign. Nobody ever resigns in the American system. It's perplexing to me. Nobody ever does the decent thing, as we used to call it. I remember after 9/11, I wrote a piece that appeared in the Chicago Sun-Times and the Washington Times and various other places. I wrote this like around September the 20th, marvelling at the way no one had resigned. And the reason I said that was because after the Falklands invasion by Argentina, the entire foreign office ministers, Lord Carrington, who was the foreign secretary, and I think it was Humphrey Atkins, who was his deputy, the whole bunch of them all resigned. Because, as Lord Carrington said, there has been a British humiliation and I have to take responsibility for it. And he did. And on September 11th, every single federal agency failed, including the State Department that had approved all those visa applications for Mohammed Atta, where he had filled in the form saying residence in the United States, holiday in America. And they just rubber-stamped it and approved it, so he was able to come here and fly into the skyscrapers and kill a bunch of people. But not just those guys, the guys at the FAA. There's a fantastic moment in the transcripts in the 9/11 inquiry where someone is calling the FAA for advice on whether they should cancel flights or whatever after the plane hits the second tower. And the guy on the phone says, I don't know what to tell you. Everybody just left the room. They basically all walked off. It was all too scary. So they all abandoned their posts. Nobody at any of the useless alphabet soup of federal agencies resigned over 9/11. What they should have done here. So resigning doesn't seem to be part of federal bureaucratic culture in the United States, which is disturbing to me. But these people shouldn't be being transferred. These people should be invited to resign before they're fired. He should have done that to Comey on day one. McCabe should have been gone long before last week. Bruce Orr, who's been downgraded to human resources, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page should never have been on the same team and should never have been both on the Hillary investigation. Or I don't know what you do with the FBI. Jeff Sessions says it's time for a fresh start. Well, you're actually, the FBI comes under the Department of Justice. You're in a position to give it a fresh start. Instead, Christopher Wray is just the usual, what do they call it here? CYA? CYA bureaucrat who sees his job as to protect his bureaucracy. And I think actually what's needed at the senior levels of the FBI is actually a total clear out. And if they can't change the culture there, because as I said, this is dangerous stuff here. It's not a small thing when they're prepared, they're actually crossing the line from police activities to secret police activities. They need to have a culture change. The other thing is, what I found interesting, and this is an important point, the Democrats are teaching us to be scared of a federal agency. They're quoting, there was some guy on Meet the Press or Face the Nation or one of these other shows who said, and everyone thinks it's the cleverest thing, like when Chuck Schumer, for example, said you shouldn't cross the intelligence community because they've got six ways to Sunday, as he put it, to screw you over. And everyone thinks that's very clever, right? That's very clever. Chuck Schumer has basically said, yes, there is a deep state and they're going to get you. And everyone said, oh, that just shows how clever Chuck Schumer is. Why? This is supposed to be a self-governing republic. Why is it clever when a senior politician tells you need to cower in fear of unelected bureaucrats? Now, some guy goes on, some FBI guy goes on TV over the weekend and he says, Trump blew into town last year. We've been at this game since 1908. Where you come up against us, we're going to win. And everybody thinks, oh, that's very clever. He's just outlined the situation that a prudent man doesn't cross the Federal Bureau of Investigation because they can get the goods on you and destroy you. The Democrats and the media are trying to train a self-governing people to be scared of their civil servants, which is absolutely, utterly contemptible. Joe Patterson writes, President Trump's lawyers are advising him not to be interviewed by Robert Mueller. Your thoughts? I agree. I think I mentioned this before. I went along to see the FBI in a related matter a few months ago. Special Agent Jenny, delightful company, had a marvelous time, splendid time. But I was actually advised not to go and see the FBI, because whatever you go and see the FBI about, even if you're not under oath, you're not talking about a matter in which there is an underlying crime. If you happen to say something to them that is not correct, which in itself is a term of art, then you can be convicted of lying to the FBI. They can basically take that to a grand jury. It can be anything. You know, they can say, he claimed to be an Elvis fan, and we asked him when Elvis died, and he said 1978, and in fact it was 1977, so he's lying to the FBI. And they may get the grand jury to indict you on that, or they may not. But actually, most of the times they can. And if you go along to see them in the District of Columbia, where Trump is, where basically it's a wholly Democratic city. I mean, it's not, if he's up against a 12-man jury in that city, Trump, then on the basis of the 2016 election, there will not be one, there's a possibility there won't be a single Trump voter on that 12-man jury. You'll have 11 and a half Democrats and then a third of a Green Party candidate, and if you're lucky, maybe two-thirds of a Trump voter. So he shouldn't go along. And because Trump, for a start, talks conversationally. And he talks, you know how he talks. Trump goes, oh, yeah, it was fabulous. It was the greatest thing ever seen. Huge ratings, unbelievable ratings. Like The Apprentice had fantastic, incredible ratings when I, you know, and then they will show that, in fact, The Apprentice's ratings in season 11 were a disappointment. So he's lied to them. So he should go down. Now, it should not be a crime to lie to the FBI, because as we now know, I used to say it should not be a crime to lie to the FBI because the FBI lies to us all the time, continuously, in fact. The FBI lies to Congress. We know from this memo that the FBI lies to judges. What's interesting about the FISA court applications is not just the material omissions, which are in effect lies by omission, in that they have a duty to lay before the judge can make a reasonable, informed decision on whether to grant a 24/7 surveillance warrant, the judge has to know the facts. If you conceal material facts, such as the truth about the man who wrote the dossier, the truth about who paid him to write about the dossier, the truth about what your own FBI has concluded about the reliability of the dossier, you are not just in effect, but as a point of law, lying to the judge. So the FBI lies to everybody. The FBI lies to judges. The FBI lies to Congress. The FBI lies to the American people. So if there is any law that should be struck from the books, it is a law that convicts people of lying to the FBI, regardless of whether or not they're under oath, or as with poor old Martha Stewart, even talking to them about a matter in which there is an underlying crime. Patty Villanova writes, with all of the latest information that's come out in the past couple of weeks, including the memo that provides a wholesale indictment of the FBI, Obama, the Clintons et al., do you believe that any one of these creeps are going to end up being led out of their homes in handcuffs? I would like to, Patty, but you have to believe at this point. I mean, you know, the Clintons at this, I don't know what the Clintons would actually have to do to be criminally indicted at this point. And I find the question of Obama even more interesting, because the question now is, I think we can take it as read that there was a conspiracy at a high level within the FBI and the Department of Justice that was not willing to accept the result of the election, and that between Election Day and January the 20th, when Trump was inaugurated, actually went to some considerable lengths to, in effect, nullify the result of the election, to cripple the Trump press. This is what it's about, really. It's nothing to do with Russia. It's nothing to do with Russia. Russia is a pretext. This is a classic wag the dog scenario in which everybody's the Democrats, basically, when they accuse Tucker Carlson of being a Russian agent. The whole Russia thing is a cover for what really happened, which was the existing incumbent government's interference with the result of the election. They did not expect Trump to win, and when he did win, they were frantic, and they wanted to find out something. I'd get the goods on him in a way that would discredit him. And at some point, let's grant this, at some point, some people involved in this might have genuinely believed that Trump had mysterious dealings with Russia. Peter Strzok wasn't one of them. As he said, there's no there there. That's why he wasn't really interested in getting mixed up with the Russia investigation, because as he saw it, there was nothing there. But there were other people who decided they could use the Russia investigation to hobble to destroy a presidency from day one. And this is why this stupid transition period, stupid like 18th century hangover that might have made sense when it, took a horse however long to get from Augusta, Maine to Washington, D.C., it might well have made sense 200 and something years ago, but it doesn't make any sense now. And the 2.5 month transition period was used by the outgoing administration to cripple the incoming administration. And the question is how far it goes. And when you look at it, Occam's razor would tend to support the theory that it went as far as the then president, Barack Obama. In other words, a lot of this stuff had to have been done with the knowledge of the Oval Office and indeed with the sign-off from the Oval Office. So it goes all the way up to Obama. Is Obama going to be in handcuffs? No, not in a million years. Not in a million years. You know, one of the funny and discreditable aspects about America is there's a group of people who are more or less impervious to law. Bill Clinton, we all actually know if you bear to listen to these women. We all actually know that he sexually assaulted women. Some of us believe Juanita Broderick was raped twice by him, because as she testified, hot damn, he said, hot damn, I can do it again, and he did it again. He's a rapist, and he got away with it. Hillary Clinton is a kleptocrat who betrayed her nation's security. It's odd to me when you look at Benghazi how well informed those gangs in the city were about the ambassador's movements. It's hard to believe there weren't systemic problems with enemies of the United States finding out, as we know with John Podesta, whose password was password with a zero for where the O should be. It's hard to believe that if it's that hard to get into John Podesta's email, it's any harder to get into Hillary's when they're kept in the toilet of some guy in Colorado. So she got away with that because she knows, no, she's never called to account. Bill's never called to account, and Barack Obama will never be called to account. And the only question is whether comparatively low-level figures are called to account. Christopher Steele, who happens to be a foreign national, may well wind up getting called to account. Account, because he's a foreigner and so doesn't count it. Incidentally, I do believe, by the way, this revelation that Christopher Steele is a long-time FBI asset, that is in breach of the Five Eyes agreement on intelligence sharing between the U.S. And basically four of Her Majesty's dominions, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia and New Zealand. And the reason they have those four countries share intelligence with the United States is they share intelligence on condition that the United States does not poach agents of those dominions of the Queen. And if they did indeed poach, if he has indeed been a long-time FBI asset, and they did poach him from MI6, that would be a breach. So there's actually some pretty big issues in here. Toby Pilling Are the dodgy dossier that the FBI used to investigate Trump and the dodgy dossier in the UK commissioned by the civil service containing scaremongering economic forecasts against Brexit both two sides of the same coin, a deep state assault on democracy? I think they're part of the same phenomenon, which is a deep state assault on democracy, Toby. I would put the Brexit thing in, and it's not a scaremongering economic forecast. Basically, it says there might be a small economic price to be paid for recovering your national sovereignty. And I think actually that if you talk to the people who voted for Brexit, they'd be willing to pay that because the Brexit vote isn't really a vote about will I be £3 a week worse off or £20 a week better off. The Brexit vote, it says, I don't really care. I'd like the United Kingdom to be a sovereign nation once again. And I think this actually gets to the heart of this is why economic arguments, I think, are increasingly irrelevant to most people. Economic arguments are irrelevant in the United States because, for example, basic family income has been stagnant here now for a couple of generations. So what it means is that even if there are economic benefits to, say, immigration, they're not going to the existing population. They may be going to global megacorping, but they're not actually doing anything for Mr. and Mrs. Jones. And that's like a lot of this economic argument against Brexit. I don't happen to believe this forecast, but even if it were true, it would suggest there is a small, barely detectable economic price to be paid for Brexit that you will not actually, Mr. and Mrs. Smith of 27 Coronation Street, Manchester, or whatever, you will not actually notice this. It will be undetectable in your lives. But at the same time, you will not be part of the European Union. You will not be subject to European law. You will not be subject to European regulation on the curvature of bananas. You will not be susceptible to huge numbers of immigrants from wherever next is let into the European Union. And the gain in sovereignty and in the preservation of your own culture is worth any economic hit you might think you would be about to take. And I think that is worth it for a lot of them. Here's another question from the Greenwich Mean Time Zone. Good evening, Mr. Stein. Across the pond here, our own deep state seem determined to deliver Brino, Brexit in name only. Without a Trump to lead us, Theresa May looks set to offer an inevitably inedible Eurofudge. I wanted to ask what you think of your former Spectator editor, Boris Johnson. Has his moment passed? The political media class, of which he is a shining example, can never forgive him for Brexit, nor has he displayed the strength of will to take them on. Do you have an opinion on the rise of Jacob Rees-Mogg? And I'm not sure whether I can... I always got on well with Boris when he was my editor. Before he was my editor at the Spectator, I remember this has got to be at least 20 years ago, maybe even longer. Might actually be 25. I remember lunch at the Spectator. They used to throw these convivial lunches. I think this was in Dominic Lawson's time as editor of the Spectator. And so we all, a bunch of us show up for lunch. Boris comes in late and announces to the table that he's sorry he's late, but he just had this sudden revelation and it occurred to him that in 20 years' time he was going to be prime minister. And I and, you know, three other people burst out laughing. And what happens 20 years' time? Everyone is suddenly talking about him at the time of Brexit for Prime Minister. He was felt to have played a very canny hand during the referendum, and they're not quite so canny in the immediate aftermath of the Tory leadership race. Boris is a very clever fellow, and it struck me as absurd when he became a member of parliament and then he kept his spectator editorship, and then he actually became mayor of London and kept his Daily Telegraph column, and he has done things that normal people seeking to transition into politics do not do, and he has managed to get away with them. And I don't rule him out. And I think there is a certain... I don't think he's Trump, because I don't think he's as philosophically grounded as Trump. But there are certain things about... I think he's very real. I remember once, while I was editor, while he was editor of The Spectator, I was a bit annoyed with him about something. I can't even remember what it was now. And I sent him a rather intemperate email. Might even have been a fax. I said, I do this for you and I do that for you. I never get anything out of The Spectator except some... When I fly into London, you take me round the corner for lunch at that lousy pasta restaurant and buy me the £3.25 special of the day. And Boris wrote back. He said, that is an outrageous slur. It was a £4.75 special of the day. And there is a certain level at which Boris's groundedness performs the same function as Trump did. Now, his poem about Erdogan, whatever it was, there once was a fellow from Ankara who was regarded as a bit of a wankerer or whatever it was. It's actually fantastic to be able to write a poem, win a literary competition for writing a poem calling Erdogan a wanker, and then becoming foreign secretary and holding a summit with Erdogan 2 weeks later. That actually performs a useful public service in expanding the bounds of public discourse and getting it away from this false, tediously sanctimonious language in which politics is generally conducted. So I thank Boris for that. And that is Trumpian, but I don't feel he's quite as attitude, not just philosophically grounded, but quite as attitudinally robust as Trump. Although Boris did complain that when he was in New York, people kept mistaking him for Donald Trump, which, you know, so I don't know. Pastor Putinesque from Flyover Country writes, the IRS was weaponized by the Obama administration. And then there was that John Doe Wisconsin debacle and the lies told to the FISA court. What has to happen before these federal monstrosities are reined in? As you say, they've crossed the border from police service to secret service in many ways. Well, you know, I think it's worse than that. I think it is secret police stuff. I think when they're getting the goods on, when, you know, what's evil about the FISA court, for example, is it approves 99.97% of requests that are laid before it. So it is a rubber stamp. And as I said, from what I know about the one judge I happen to have been in a room with, this Frank Maas guy, I nearly drove off the road listening to Shep Smith the other day when Shep said, well, these are almost like Supreme Court justices. No, they're not. These are rubber stamps. These decisions are given quickly and 99.97% in favour of the government. And the other party isn't even in the room. The other party doesn't even know it's attracted the attention of the United States government. So it's interesting to me that they made these applications earlier in the summer and they were denied, because I would like to know what it was the FBI did that was so unusual as to make their applications one of the 0.03% of applications to the FISA court that are denied. That's interesting to me. I think the FISA court should. I generally think the protections against U.S. citizens should be increased. I don't think you should be able to do to Americans what was done to Carter Page, where Carter Page isn't really the target of this investigation. Nobody cares about Carter Page, but they're using Carter Page to get to other U.S. citizens who have committed no crimes, have been accused of no crimes, have no probable cause of any crimes. But nevertheless, it's understood that this is kind of lily pond hopping. That so-and-so opens the door to so-and-so party. I mean, for start, this is hearsay upon... It's a court that relies on hearsay upon hearsay upon hearsay upon hearsay upon hearsay. And then uses somebody, the so-called target of the investigation, to draw in friends of friends of friends of friends of friends and thereby hop across the lily pad to the guy they're really targeting. That shouldn't be permitted. That shouldn't be permitted. And I think there is actually something to be said for taking Shepard Smith at his word and saying that if this stuff is so vital to national security, then why don't you bring it to a Supreme Court judge? There's 9 Supreme Court justices. My understanding is they don't have the heaviest load, certainly compared with other equivalent jurisdictions. Why don't you have them rotating in and out as FISA court judges and actually getting a Supreme Court judge to sign off on some of this stuff? I think it needs to be done at a much higher level. And I'll put it this way as well, that if you need actually the director of the FBI and either the attorney general or the deputy attorney general to sign off on the application, you should have an equivalently senior member of the judiciary, as opposed to rubber stamp hacks signing off on it too. Now, when you talk about the John Doe debacle in Wisconsin and the weaponization of the IRS, you're talking, I think, about something far worse there, because you're talking about not just skullduggery and machinations of a deeply complex intertwining kind. I mean, there is an element of John le Carré to what's going on in the FBI stuff. But the IRS is just basic Banana Republic 101, where you use the taxing authorities to punish your political enemies. And likewise with the Wisconsin thing as well. Now, one of the interesting things about that is that people in Wisconsin, people were scared because they had dawn raids and they were in which people kick the door down and point guns at them. And at that moment, you're terrified you're going to be killed. And the state is sending you a message that it has the power to kill you and no one's going to even know or care why you were killed. That's a serious problem. And I think, likewise, the weaponization of the IRS is a serious problem for ordinary Americans. There are two things here. Americans have, frankly, to recover the sense of themselves as free-born citizens. It's tough. It's much easier to say, I'll just keep quiet and I won't make a fuss. But actually, whenever one bureaucracy gets away with this kind of stuff, it emboldens another bureaucracy. The IRS, I think, is a complete... Until all the people who did that are cleared out, it's a delegitimized entity. And that doesn't mean there aren't nice IRS agents here and IRS agents there, but it does mean that the stench of corruption hangs over them because it was never expunged, because that creep Koskinen, who treated Congress with contempt, basically ignored any kind of oversight and paid no price. And likewise with what happened in Wisconsin. People need to get mad about this and stand up to this. And it's one of those spread the risk things that I always talk about, because they can't kill everyone. They can't kill everyone. So people, when you get accused of in these John Doe things, you need to say, screw you, I'm going public. You have to be willing to stand up to them, and you have to be willing to get it out there in public. Michelle Dulac writes, this morning on NPR, there was a former FBI agent who insisted that the Nunez memo didn't tell the truth about what the Steele dossier said, because there was a footnote indicating that Steele was paid by political operatives. But she didn't say that it was the HRC campaign. Does this make any difference? No, it doesn't. I linked, when I wrote about this, I linked to the Steele dossier directly. I linked to this Frank Maas, Judge Frank Maas campaign complaint directly, because I always think it's good to look at what the original documents say. The Steele dossier is interesting, because there's nothing in there about Carter Page that would warrant a year of surveillance on him. What it tells you is that in July he made a trip to Russia, and he gave a speech, and in the course of giving a speech in Russia, he had a few secret meetings. And by secret meetings, that's spook talk for private meetings, just as after this show, I'll be having some secret meetings, in the sense that you out there in radio land won't be in on the meeting. And I think the FBI, and to have an FBI agent saying that the Nunez memo didn't tell the truth, you can read the Nunez memo, and then you can look at the Steele dossier and see for yourself. What's clear is that Nunez has said, and the easiest way, there's no national security reason to get any, not to have any of this out. In fact, the biggest damage to national security in this whole rotten, stinking business was when, in fact, they decided to disclose Kislyak's conversation with Michael Flynn, the former, briefly, the Trump national security guy. Flynn and Kislyak, the Russian ambassador in Washington, have a conversation on what Kislyak assumes is a secure line. And Kislyak then discovers that it's actually beyond that. Kislyak knows there are certain public telephone lines that he can't talk about sensitive matters on. And so the Russians, like everybody else, arranged to have certain secure lines. And in order to get Michael Flynn, the deep state was willing to reveal to Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, that they'd penetrated his secure lines because it was more important to them to stick it to Trump. So the only national security loss so far in this whole stupid phony business came actually from those guys. What actually we need, there's nothing in the Russia investigation involving clandestine agents and all that. There's no Russians in the Russian investigation. There's no double agents in St. Petersburg or anywhere else who are in the Russian investigation. So let's see the applications to the FISA court. Let's actually see them. The American people have the right to see this stuff. Stuff is classified too easily in America generally, in Washington generally. And most of this stuff shouldn't be. Alan Miller writes, Mark, I was delighted to learn that the Russians were able to swing the US elections by means of $50,000 in Facebook ads. I was tempted to make use of this trick myself, but unfortunately I can't be US president due to some petty racist anti-Dreamer legislation about the candidates having a US passport. I therefore propose the following high-stakes high-roller deal. If you put yourself up to be president in 2020, I will sell my car and pony up the money to Putin. After you are elected, you can pay me back the $50,000 from some Solara-type slush fund. I will buy another car and we're all good. I know what you're thinking. This is Washington. Nobody does something for nothing. Well, yes, but if you can let me doss down in the White House whenever I'm visiting the Beltway, as I'll tell my friends, I'll call it quits. The hotel saving will easily cover the lost interest on my capital. Now, that's what Trump would call a deal, said Allen. Yeah, Allen makes the point that... Yeah, and actually the Democrats are still doing this because there was some guy, what's he called, Congressman Swalwell, I was on Tucker with the other night, this Democrat from California, who's complaining that the Democrats are complaining that Putin's Russian bots, his Russian Twitter bots, are retweeting... retweeting the Nunes memo thing. So in other words, these Russian bots, so-called, we don't actually even know if there are any Russian bots. They might just be regular Twitter bots. Everyone is on Twitter bots. You can fight the Cold War. Russian bots can fight American bots on Twitter with no real persons having to be involved. But the Democrats are mad because Putin stole the election by buying $50,000 worth of Facebook ads. And what he thereby revealed was that you can buy a US election for peanuts, because everybody else... Hillary spent $1 billion and she had the election stolen from her by Vladimir Putin, who bought 50 grand's worth of Facebook ads. So what does that tell you? If you're thinking of running in 2020... get Vladimir Putin to handle your campaign expenditures. You know, Jeb Bush, he had Mike Murphy. Mike Murphy is supposed to be a genius in American politics. He and I have had some back and forth over the years. Mike Murphy spent $100 million to get Jeb Bush to 2.8% in Iowa. Vladimir Putin bought 50 grand's worth of Facebook ads and won. That's the guy who should be running your campaign. I don't know if Bernie is thinking of running in 2020. There's talk that somebody may primary Donald Trump on the Republican side, Jeff Flake, Mitt Romney. Kristen Gillibrand in New York is thinking of running on the Democrat side. Hillary thinks third time's a charm. Don't waste your money this time. Just all you need to do is say, Vlad, you did a terrific job for 50 grand in Facebook ads last time. I'd like to give you like a $70,000 Facebook advertising budget. Could you win the election for me? Don't waste time giving $100 million to Mike Murphy, who'll put it all into mailing lists and irritating flyers and pictures of Jeb with an exclamation mark after his name. Say, Mike, you did a terrific... Jeb is probably thinking of running again in 2020. He's America's president in waiting. It's... Jeb, don't be a fool. Don't have Mike. Say, Mike, you did a great job. Honestly, really appreciated it. Was very grateful for the 2.8% in Iowa. It was terrific. But this time round, I'm not going to go with the $100 million budget to get to 2.8% in Iowa. I think I'm going to give 50 grand to Vladimir Putin to win the election for me. And I'll keep the other, whatever that is, 99,950,000 all to myself. That's the way to do it. Kevin Zarabinski says, Dear Mark, I've noticed that in all the upheaval of the Nunes memo, nobody has commented, as far as I've noticed, on a far more startling potential issue. My question is, between the NSA mass spying and the FBI playing politics, if that is what we know about, what are we still in the dark about? I think this is right, actually, Kevin, that we are in the age of the panopticon state, in which all the information can be accessed. I gather now, by the way, even if you send a birthday card to your grandma, and you write it in hand, you write, you know, to Granny at 27 Elm Street, Smallville, the United States Postal Service actually photographs that hand, the front of that handwritten envelope, And the fact that you sent a birthday card to your grandma goes into a database. And the interesting thing about the panopticon state is that everything is known. The only argument is about the meaning of what of the information they have. And the argument about the meaning is what is critical. Emily Maximov writes, "Hi Mark, in case there's any time for any non-memo related questions, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the removal of the Victorian painting from Manchester Gallery this week. Their decision to temporarily remove the painting was fueled by the Me Too movement and claimed that it was not censorship, but just a way to encourage debate about how such images should be displayed. How is there to be any debate if no one can actually see the painting? Is this just a publicity stunt, or are we really to the point of censoring paintings from 1896? Well, I didn't actually... this is a new one on me. I'm going to find out right now what it is. This 1896 Manchester Gallery painting removal. Okay, I'm typing as few... Go have a listen to Kenny Ball playing Midnight in Moscow before. Oh, one of Waterhouse's... Our removal of Waterhouse's Naked Nymphs was Art in Action by Sonia Boyce. And this is one of those... this is a painting by John Waterhouse. I've actually seen this painting. 1896 painting, Hylas and the Nymphs, which depicts Hercules' handsome male lover being lured to his death in a pond by seven long-haired, topless nymphs. they said, as you say they've taken it down to start a debate. Yeah, as you say, you're not censoring by taking a debate. By preventing anybody, you're not censoring people by or starting a debate by preventing people from seeing it. We're going to see a lot more of this. In the normal course of events, the artist. Would the artist's decisions as an artist would be respected? They're arguing that it's sexist. They're arguing that he's objectifying the women. He's a man of the 19th century painting a painting. And throughout history, the subjects that engage artists vary. So for much of the last 2,000 years, religious iconography, depiction of biblical scenes, things that painters don't do much now. You can go to the Turner Prize or whatever. You won't see a lot of, you won't see the rape of the Sabine women. You won't, and then other subjects that engaged artists of our time were scenes from mythology. Art. We are entitled to accord the artist a degree of artistic integrity, which means that you don't second guess him from a century later by demanding that he paint within the parameters of what you permit him to paint. So actually, we now have art galleries who are waging war on artistic expression. We're going to be seeing a lot more of this because this is where the left meets radical Islam. This is where radical Islam, which doesn't like representative figures anyway and doesn't like naked women, and this is where the Me Too movement and radical Islam meet. But you're going to be seeing, go to a public gallery now, go to a private gallery now, look at the paintings on the wall, enjoy the paintings on the wall, appreciate the great artistic inheritance of our civilization and weep, because in 10, 20 years' time, many of those paintings are going to be down in a basement somewhere, if we're lucky, not on show, or if we're unlucky, will have actually been destroyed. But you're right, that is a big story, Emily, and I'm glad we were able to touch on it just there. We never got to Jason, Justin Trudeau, mansplaining to a woman that who'd asked him a question about mankind, and Justin Trudeau mansplained to her that she should say peoplekind. I don't know the dweebiest politically correct person who actually talks about peoplekind. I've heard people say humankind, but I've never heard anybody say peoplekind until Justin Trudeau. I don't even know that. People who say people kind are the kind of people you should avoid. So we didn't get to Justin Trudeau. We may do that next time. This has been a Clubland Q&A live around the planet. The time has just gone 5 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 10 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 1 a.m. in the Kremlin, where Vladimir Putin is wiring me this month's paycheck right now. We will see you next time.